All right, so I should mention that this work is mainly in collaboration with, the Monte Carlo part I'll present was done by Erez Berg, and also many of the ideas were developed by Erez and Max. And towards the end, I may mention a few things done in collaboration with Matthias Punk. Okay, Max is now at Santa Barbara, Erez, postdoc at Harvard, who is going on to be faculty at Weizmann, you know, next month. And Matthias Punk is a postdoc at Harvard. Okay, so you all know this famous phase diagram where you have high temperature superconductivity and antiferromagnetism in the hole-doped cuprates. And looking at this phase diagram, you know, we have one of two possible reactions. One is that antiferromagnetism is the most important thing and really responsible for superconductivity. And the other is they have nothing to do with each other. And, you know, that debate has been going on for 20 years. And I won't have much to say on that debate, but let me go to the other side with electron-doped materials. And here, you know, there's clearly a qualitative difference in that the antiferromagnetism clearly overlaps with the region of super high-temperature superconductivity. The TCs are lower, but they're still quite high, up to 50 degrees Kelvin. And so most of my talk will really be trying to understand this side. Okay, I'll say a few things about the left-hand side later. So if I look at the electron-doped side, you know, many of the mysteries of the hole-doped side are also present. So for example, if you look at the temperature dependent on the resistivity, it has the famous linear resistivity over a wide range of doping and temperatures. But more recently, of course, we have a second class of high-temperature superconductors. And one of the most spectacular is this compound, barium iron arsenic phosphorus, where in this recent paper, there's been some beautiful indication now of strong connection between antiferromagnetism and superconductivity. Again, topologically, the phase diagram looks almost identical to the electron-doped cuprates. You have spin density wave, which is the same as antiferromagnetism, vanishing at some quantum critical point, which is pretty close to the position of maximum TC. And you have non-Fermi liquid behavior in the resistivity exponent. Okay. Also, for the first time in this particular paper, they had some very beautiful measurements of the superconducting properties along this line. They measured the London penetration depth. And as they went along this line at low temperatures within the superconducting phase, they see this very pronounced peak in the London penetration depth. And that peak is precisely at this point. So that very explicit connection then between the quantum critical point in the magnetism and a measurement in the electricity, in the superconductivity. So showing you that they're not really some phase separated different phenomena, but they're really entangled with each other, so to speak. Okay, and then there are other compounds with lower TC, various heavy fermion compounds like the 115 compounds, where also you have very similar phase diagram of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity. So my purpose here mostly will be to address the issue of, you know, what happens in a metal when you have this sort of a critical point where antiferromagnetism disappears, and whether and how superconductivity appears near that point. So that's an old question. Many things have been said about it, and we have a few more things to add to it. So all the physics of spin liquids, well, in the sense, particular mod insulator physics, will not play much of a role, at least in the first three quarters of my talk, depending on how I go. Okay, so here's the outline. I'll just begin with a review of the weak coupling theory. You know, if you open your textbooks and you do a Hartree-Fock theory of antiferromagnetism in a metal, what do you get? I'm just going to review some of the basic properties. Now, what's been understood in the past 2 or 3 years is that that mean field theory has serious problems when you look at fluctuations. And I'll summarize our current understanding of the quantum field theory of antiferromagnetism in a metal. And the problems are especially severe in two dimensions, which is, of course, the most interesting case. All of the materials I showed you are quasi-two-dimensional. And we reached a point in those calculations that things just kept flowing to strong coupling, and so we needed a new approach, and that new approach is what I'll present here on quantum Monte Carlo ideas. And then the last part, if I have time, I'll talk about, of course, the whole dope cuprase, where we almost surely need some new sets of ideas. Okay, so let me just review the mean weak coupling theory. So suppose I start with the Hubbard model on the square lattice with next first and second neighbor hopping, say. And I don't want to be near half-filling. So I'm at some generic density, and I'm just going to do weak coupling expansion mean field theory in U. Okay, and let me just describe some of the things that come about. So one approach then is to take this four Fermi term here. There's a four Fermi term NN, and you decouple it by Hubbard-Sultanovich transformation. So you introduce a scalar. You know, now it's, as you're debating over lunch, is this a fundamental scalar or is it a composite scalar? Well, it just depends on your point of view. You introduce a scalar phi, which is a vector, which couples to C dagger C. And if you just if you ignore this term and you integrate over phi, you will get back, for appropriate parameters, the Hubbard model. So this is just a rewriting of the Hubbard model, where I have a free fermion sector and have another sector, phi, which is related to the antiferromagnetism. Of course, I've chosen, I'm anticipating that that's the low-energy boson that's going to emerge. So the low-energy boson is a vector in spin space, and it's a scalar in, it's just a boson. I haven't even put in a kinetic term because it's not, all the kinetic terms come from this three-point Yukawa coupling. So the fact that antiferromagnetism comes from this factor here, e to the I k dot r, where k is the antiferromagnetic wave vector. Okay, so the trouble with this approach, of course, is that the coupling constant, the nonlinearity lambda, is the strongest energy scale. It's of order u, which is large. And so why should we believe any of this? And why indeed? But let's just go ahead and see what this approach tells you. So the idea then is we have two ingredients. We have the electrons, which form a nice Fermi surface. It's a metal. And then we have this boson phi, which is the spin density wave at the wave vector k. And I'm going to take k equals pi pi, say, so corresponding to this kind of antiferromagnetic order. Okay? So now if you do the Hartree-Fock theory and you try the optimal value of phi, so then under suitable conditions, you'll find that this phi field condenses. So you're in the Higgs phase. So phi is the Higgs boson, which is condensed. So if phi is condensed, then you have a new term in the Hamiltonian. This is exactly how the Higgs boson gives a mass to the electron. Here, the Higgs boson is going to reconstruct the Fermi surface. Okay, so your effective Hamiltonian then has a new term, which is the Higgs condensate of phi times C dagger C. And now the crucial feature here is that this, goes back to this factor of e to the I k dot r, which is also over here, this means that the momentum carried by one electron is differed from the momentum of the other one by this momentum k. Okay, so now you have this matrix to diagonalize. It's a 2x2 matrix. You diagonalize, you get a dispersion spectrum, and you fill up the lowest energy states, and that tells you what the electronic spectrum is in the Higgs phase, which is the antiferromagnetic phase. Okay? Let me just show you that procedure pictorially. You start with the original Fermi surface. Then you remember you're mixing with an electron with Fermi momentum shifted by k. So you shift the Fermi surface by k. And in the Brillouin zone, there's four different ways of doing it. And then I want to focus attention on these special points where you have the circles intersect. These are the hot spots. These are the special points where both Ek and Ek plus k are zero. And so you notice then the spectrum is very simple. E is just plus or minus phi. And so there's a gap. There's no low energy states. So you're going to open up gaps at these so-called hot spots. And then you ask for where the Fermi surface is. Well, it has this shape. Okay, so these are called the pockets where you've reconstructed the Fermi surface into electron and hole pockets. So So what I've just reviewed for you is a very simple mean field theory of as you turn some parameter, you have two phases. You have the symmetric phase where phi is zero with just a metal. And then you have the Higgs phase, you break the spin rotation symmetry and you reconstruct the Fermi surface. Okay, so that's what we want to start with. These are two possible limiting cases. Yes?
So how would you have known from this approach that k should be 2 to be pi pi?
Certainly there are parameters for which that's the self-consistent solution. So I'm just assuming that I'm in such a regime, working backwards from the experiment. There could be solutions, of course, with other values of k, but it's certainly true that there's a whole regime where k equals pi pi is stable, that it won't move from pi pi. So it's not like in 1D where if you have nesting, then you always pin to be at some nesting wave vector. That doesn't happen in 2D for a generic Fermi surface. Yeah.
So you introduce some bosonic degrees of freedom.
Well, I mean, everything's exact. If you the boson is to your taste, whether you want to think of it as there or not. It's convenient to think of it as there.
The question is, where is the approximation? Is there an approximation?
The only approximation here is the mean field theory. So this is up to this point. This theory is exact. And now I just replace phi by a constant. So I just do mean field theory. Okay. All right. So now we want to, really the question is, how good is this mean field theory? What's happening in this regime? We know when you're far out here, everything is good. It's stable. It's a Fermi liquid. Lambda Fermi liquid theory applies. Again, similarly, when you're down here, it's a Fermi liquid as far as electrons are concerned. There are some Goldstone modes present, but that they don't change the Fermi liquid behavior very much, and it's also stable. So the question is, what's happening in between? Okay, that's the question we're trying to answer. So first, let me just show you that there's, at least for the electron dope cuprate, there's a lot of evidence this picture is correct. There's, in fact, photo emission experiments showing you precisely this type of reconstruction of the Fermi surface. This goes back quite a bit while. But more recent, there have been very beautiful measurements of quantum oscillations, where you see, as you change the doping, you go from a small period to a large period, small frequency to a large frequency, corresponding to, and this I won't go into it, from these measurements you can read off the size of the Fermi surface, and it's generally compatible with that kind of change. All right, so let's study this further. So now, in fact, another observation goes back a long time, even before the discovery of ITC, in this paper of Scalapino, Lowe, and Hirsch, where they pointed out that if you looked at fluctuations precisely near such a transition, a spin density wave instability in the Hubbard model, that there is spin singlet pairing the D wave channel, and so on. So really, it's a remarkable paper. The only thing they didn't do was talk about the square lattice. They talked about the cubic lattice. Well, this was in 1986, before the discovery of ITC. But we got almost everything right. All right, so what was the content of that their paper? The content is, you put in one higher order fluctuation. So here's the same Yukawa coupling, phi C dagger C. And now you put in Gaussian fluctuations of phi, let's be in the normal state. So you integrate out phi, you get some induced interaction between your electrons, which is going to look like this. And then you just apply a BCS mean field theory to this type of theory. And it's worth to go through that once in your life. And what you find is you get a solution, a gap equation that looks like this. It has a solution provided the following condition holds true, that the pairing amplitude, Cooper pair amplitude, at two momenta must change sign whenever these momenta differ by approximately k. So here's sort of the picture of that. You have electrons sitting on the Fermi surface, and the electron gets scattered by this boson along this orange line. So this electron gets scattered by the boson from here to there. So that's right, okay. And so the bosonic field is present and it's scattering electrons between these states. And so what this argument shows you that you have an attractive interaction between this pair of electrons here and these pair of electrons connected to it by the scattering process, which is this. So the colors of the electron tells you the sign of the gap. So the, where we have green electrons, you have positive sign of the gap, say. Red electrons, you have negative sign of the gap. Okay, here's a more conventional way of drawing it. So the pairing amplitude is D wave for this kind of Fermi surface, where gap changes sign as you go around. Okay. All right, so that's one of the conclusions then of this analysis, that if you looked, come in the middle here, and again, weak coupling theory, look at what happens, you at low enough temperatures, you have instability to D wave pairing. Okay. So what this means is that if I took this phase diagram at finite temperature, initially you might think that you have a quantum critical point between these two metallic states with some quantum critical physics in between, perhaps connected to the strange metal. I won't say much about that. But at low enough temperatures, this sort of theory suggests that there's some kind of instability to D-wave superconductivity. And so the metallic critical point is always unstable to some superconducting state, where you go from coexisting spin density wave plus superconductivity to ordinary superconductivity, just as you see for sure in the nictides. Okay, so now really the question is, ultimately, this all sounds great, but can we believe it when lambda is large? This is all based upon small lambda perturbation theory. Okay? Yeah?
Can you have any kind of super solid in your theory? Super solid in the sense that the charge density wave points is
the yes, density. Yes, you can. So there's also a subdominant instability to a certain kind of charge density wave of that type, but it's smaller, it's weaker than the D wave. The D wave is the strongest. Okay, I won't go into that, but we have looked at all. Yeah, so, right. Okay, so really the question is, what happens when you turn off the coupling? To what extent can I believe this? Can I get, you know, high enough TCs from this approach? And, you know, why is this weak coupling? You know, if you actually, in the regime you can believe this, your TCs would be exponentially small. So is this high, true enough TC for theory for high TC? So what are some of the problems? So let's just turn on the coupling. When we turn on the coupling, well, sure, yes, you're going to enhance the pairing. That's great. No, but that's not the only effect. When you turn on the coupling, other things could happen. You will also find that this pairing interaction can scatter electrons. And in fact, you know, so that it has a very short lifetime. And so the quasi-particles that are pairing don't really even exist. So that's bad for superconductivity. And then at larger coupling, there could be other effects, charge density waves, you know, whatever, as you mentioned. And who knows whether they're good or bad. So this is really the essence of the problem. How do we balance all this? And do we know this thing works as strong coupling? Okay. All right, so I'm going to describe two approaches to go beyond this established mean field theory. One using quantum field theory, which is to summarize what we've learned, and the second using quantum Monte Carlo. But I want to present this because it was this approach that gave us some ideas on how to get rid of the sign problem. You know, in general, if I give you this Hubbard model and you put it on a computer, you can't do anything with it. So we're going to have to modify the model somehow to get rid of the sign problem. And we're going to use some insight from the quantum field theory to figure out how we are allowed to modify it.
Can you say again, what's that, the strength of this coupling?
This lambda?
Yeah, you said
just the Hubbard repulsion U. It's the very largest energy scale in the problem. So
at the very beginning, it's strong,
yes.
That you told us is
under. Yeah, so I'm just summarizing the weak coupling theory. Now I want to go to strong coupling and see how much of this we can believe. So. Okay, so let me tell you the analytic approach. So the analytic approach assumes anyway that the starting point is correct. The starting point is a metal which is about to go antiferromagnetic and then tries to treat that quantum phase transition as best as we can, even in the strong coupling limit. Okay. So what the idea there is, if you remember, all of the action happened both for the pairing and the Fermi surface reconstruction at these special points on the Fermi surface, right? Okay. So what we can argue then is that you can just zoom in on one of those points. So let's just take one of those points, and in fact, we're going to take all of them, and try to write down some low-energy theory for what's happening near one of these points. So let's just take one of those points, and here I've rewritten it. So now you don't have a complicated Fermi surface. Your Fermi surface is just lines. There's one straight line this way and one straight line that way. These are Fermi lines, so your electron has one of the electrons with color red has dispersion with Fermi velocity V1, and the other has dispersion with Fermi velocity V2. And then you have a boson which connects them at the point where they intersect. So that's the field theory. Now, if you want, I can write this out. Let's say chalk. You know, it's again, the type of field theory that formally looks similar to that things you might see in particle physics, but not quite. So this field phi. So that's your order parameter. And then you have your fermions. And the fermions are psi dagger 1, d by d tau minus I, v1 dot k psi 1, or v1 dot grad, sorry. And then you have psi dagger 2, d2 minus v2 dot grad psi 2, plus Yukawa couplings phi psi dagger 1, sigma psi 2. That's it. So this is, you know, if you know particle physics, you might have some Higgs boson, you might have some Dirac fermions, and you have a Yukawa coupling. So these kind of things you might call as a Gross-Naveau model. So what is the difference? The difference is that these are not Dirac fermions. These are fermions who have energy which vanishes on a line in momentum space. So the energy here of this fermion, Ek, is V dot K. And that has a zero on a whole line. And for a Dirac fermion, the energy would be mod K, which is completely different. That has a zero on a point. That's really what makes all the difference and why this is a much, much more difficult problem. It's the difference between this and this. If you had this, we can solve it, no problem. Okay, so you have these lines of zeros intersecting, and there's your theory. Okay. So you could take this theory now and try to do various expansions on it, and I won't bore you with all of this. You know, there's been 10, 15 years of work on this. And the best expansion that's come up is a 1 over n expansion, where you just put in another index A in the fermion, so it's a vector 1 over n, and then you have n flavors of fermions, and you do 1 over n expansion. That seems to be rather well behaved, but eventually at higher order in the 1 over n expansion, there are problems. So let me just summarize what we have learned from all of these methods for this field theory. We've learned quite a bit, but you know, the reason I'm not spending more time on it is that those expansions are ultimately not under control. Okay. All right, so this is the theory. I've already explained that. And we organize in powers of 1 over n. And as we showed following some work of Sung-Sik Lee for another problem, that unfortunately the 1 over n expansion doesn't work. But you have to go to 3 loops before you start seeing that problem. but at that point, you realize you have to sum all planar graphs and even something worse. So things become rather complicated, and many years of our life were spent on this, but this is where I won't inflict it on you. but it's quite amazing. There's such a simple field theory with that very simple innocuous change in the electronic dispersion is what leads to all this incredible richness. Yeah.
What does it mean that doesn't work?
Okay. All right. So in the usual 1 over n expansion, if you want to write down all graphs at a particular order in 1 over n, you simply count fermion loops. So the more loops you have, the more higher order in 1 over n. And that seems to be what happens here at low order. But higher order, you get some additional infrared divergences that tell you that counting powers of 1 over n is not as simple as you thought. And you have to include many, many graphs. At the very least, you have to include all planar graphs. So even at order 1 over n, you have to sum an infinite set of graphs. There's no finite set of graph at each order. You know, of course, in QCD, you're familiar with this kind of thing. That's exactly what happens in QCD 2 in the large n limit, but that's a matrix large n expansion. Here you have similar and in some sense worse problems already in the vector large n expansion. And it's tied to this dispersion change in the electron in the fermion. Okay? Nevertheless, let's just go to two loops and let me just summarize what we learned. Okay, so what we learned are the following. First of all, you find, yes, indeed, right at this point, there's non-Fermi liquid behavior. You get the square root of omega singularity in the self-energy. So there's no pole, there's no quasi. So fermionic quasi-particles don't exist here. Now, in some sense, that's bad news, because that's precisely the point where the attraction was the strongest to form D-wave pairs. So exactly where you wanted to form D-wave pairs, the quasi-particles don't exist. So that should worry you on the D-wave pairing. On the other hand, if you're near this point, then you find there is a quasi-particle pole, so omega minus vk perp. But the residue vanishes as you approach this point. Okay. So the quasi-particle, the electrons are pretty well defined, but they become weaker and weaker and weaker and disappear as you approach that point. Okay, so now you could go in and solve the BCS gap equation for these new sets of quasiparticles. This is the actual electronic spectrum that you think is there. So let's go back and redo Scalapino's calculation in a more serious manner in this 1 over n expansion. So if you did Scalapino's calculation, his result is this, that there is an enhancement in the pairing vertex by a term of order lambda squared times rho of EF. But we can only believe this when lambda squared is small and you're far away from the critical point, in which case this is a small correction. And at very low frequencies or temperatures, you of course instability to pairing. So that's the way you get TC in good old-fashioned BCS theory. So we redid that calculation, and we found quite a remarkable result. We found that the coefficient actually is independent of lambda near the critical point. It's just a constant, and that constant is the sine theta, where sine theta is this angle between V1 and V2. So it's a remarkably universal result, and it comes with a log squared, so it's stronger than BCS. So this is, in some sense, a good answer. That's why I put a smiley face, because it tells you that the underlying physics of this answer is that the pairing instability is stronger than the non-Fermi liquid physics. The breakdown of the quasi-particle is weaker, the pairing effects dominate, and they actually dominate because of these electrons here, away from the hotspot. So those quasi-particles are marginally well-defined, and they have a strong but not infinitely strong attractive interaction, as is present at that point. So anyway, when you take all those tendencies into account, you get this universal answer. The log squared is also a very generic feature of any shape Fermi surface, suggesting that there is, in fact, some kind of instability to pairing. And that's the dominant instability. So we can say that all of these other instabilities, charge density wave and so on, are weaker. This is the dominant one. But unfortunately, this result is not under control. We don't know how to go to higher order, even approximately. It's just we haven't tried. Okay. Yeah?
What about the work by Sensor, et cetera, where you try to add to this 1 over n expansion with this additional parameter?
Okay, so first of all, that's for a different model. That's for the gauge field model, not the spin density wave model. And secondly, that model introduces by hand a long-range interaction. It's not a local theory anymore. In fact, artificially sets a certain critical exponent to have a certain value. So if you did the same kind of long-range interaction for the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, ordinary scalar field theory, you would get the wrong answer. So I don't buy that, really. I don't buy that approach at all. In the end, it's not going to solve the problem you want to solve. I know I've had arguments with Senthil of this, but... but a good question anyway. But you could apply it here. I mean, we've tried, but it doesn't really cure the problem, I think. So to summarize then, for the field theory, I think, ultimately we flow to strong coupling. It's hard to prove anything. It's hard to quantitatively estimate anything. But the weight of the evidence from this whole approach is that there is indeed D-wave pairing at a relatively high scale, right, and near any such anti-ferromagnetic critical point. Okay, so that's where we were about a year ago, so we want to do better. So that brings me to the main part of my talk, which is quantum Monte Carlo without the sign problem. All right, so as I said, if I take this model and put it in a computer, you're dead. Okay, you could do, 5x5, 6x6, and then that's it. and it becomes exponentially harder the larger the system size because of the sign problem. So how are we going to do it? So let's just take something away from all this hard work. And all this hard work told us that all the important physics is in this structure, in this kind of field theory. So this is how we started thinking. So forget the original model. It's too difficult. Can we put this model on the computer? Can you write down some lattice model which at low energy limit looks like this? It doesn't have to be the Hubbard model. After all, this is where all of these problems that we're having, the one breakdown of the one over n expansion, the pairing, the quasi-particle, all of it's in here. So forget the original model, put this on a computer. Now, if this was a direct fermion, no problem. You just take a honeycomb lattice like graphene and you put it in a scalar and let it run, and that has no sign problem. People have done that already. And there's no, So again, it's this, the difference between this is what causes the difficulty. Okay, so what's special about this dispersion I've already emphasized is these lines of zeros in the electron dispersion. Now notice these lines keep going. They don't really end. And that's another feature. So if I take any lattice model, you're always going to, these lines are going to just keep going forever. You can't just cut them. If you cut them, you've caused problems. There's a fermion line, Fermi surface lines don't just end, okay? They have to keep going. So that's the heart of the problem. So we want to be able to put this on a lattice in a way that also has no sign problem and in which the Fermi lines don't end. They can't just end. So this is the challenge we posed ourselves. And it wasn't at all clear there is any solution, but I'll show you there is, in fact, a very simple solution. So let's go back to the original problem. So the original problem really has, depending how you count, but really four copies of this theory. Okay, this point is the same as that point because that was translated by pi pi, and similarly for the other. So there's four copies of this theory with some square lattice symmetry built in, right? So let me just take those four copies. I really have four of them. And if I go back and look at these four pieces, the Fermi surface here is connected to the Fermi surface there, but that point is the same as that point, or it's really connected to this Fermi surface, and so on. So these four copies of this theory are actually connected in some complicated way now. Okay, all right. This is just a redrawing of this, okay? Nothing different. They're connected in some way. So what I'm going to argue is that all you have to do is reconnect them like that. And amazingly, that gets rid of the sign problem. That's all. You can be any density you want. You can have any dispersion. You just have to have this kind of reconnection. So what is this? So let me go back to the original coordinate system. So here were our original eight hotspots. So this new reconnection corresponds to taking this Fermi surface and turning it into this Fermi surface, okay? So now you notice there are two sheets. You know, they don't have to be in any, they, the shape of this is totally irrelevant. But is this, this Fermi surface comes back and meets this one and this one. So there's, and you can make these part of the same Fermi band and this part of that band. So now you have two bands with four sheets of Fermi surface. The most important property is that if I, if this fermion now, psi one and psi two, if psi one lives here, then psi two lives over here. And notice psi one is in this band and psi two is in a different band. That's what we need. We need psi one and psi two to really be belong to different bands, not the same band. And as far as this theory is concerned, it doesn't care. As far as this theory is concerned, they are in different bands. It's just an accident of the original Hubbard model that psi one and psi two actually eventually around there got reconnected. But who cares? Let's disconnect them. So instead of working in this model, we work in this model. So now the most important property is now if I'm near this point and here, I haven't changed a thing. It looks exactly the same. So as far as the Fermi surface and order parameter physics is concerned, it's all the same. What I have changed is things over here. You know, I've reconnected them. Okay, now I can't prove that that change doesn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I can't. I mean, this is a different model now. But what I can prove is that all of these infrared singularities to all orders in 1 over n for every graph of this theory and this theory are the same. Okay, so at least solving this problem will help me solve this problem. That's what I claim, okay, which is the thing, something we want to do. Here is a strongly coupled field theory that we want to solve, and it can be, the point is this field theory can be regularized in a way that gets rid of the sign problem. So that's my main claim. And to prove it actually just takes a few lines once you realize this is a good thing to do. Okay, so another way to see it, and I'll show you a little bit more. Some of you may know that, you know, when you do fermion determinant Monte Carlo, you get a determinant of some fermion that you have to evaluate. And one way to get rid of the fermion sign problem is to get determinant squared. And so if you double everything, you know, if you have two layers or something, they'd be coupled, then you can get determinant squared, but then you have changed the problem so much. So here we are going to get a determinant squared. And the way we get a determinant squared is by using Cramer's degeneracy. It turns out the spin-up electron and spin-down electrons always give the same determinant for this model, even though they're strongly coupled to each other, even though they have different word lines. And it's linked to Cramer's degeneracy. So we're just using time reversal symmetry in a fundamental way to get this.
But in the previous model, can you use the same?
For this model? This model, unfortunately, you can't. Well, it's... You do, but I can't prove the determinant is positive. I mean, so let me just, maybe this will make it clear. So you start with this model, where you have one band of electrons, and then I deform it to this model, where I have two bands, call them X and Y, and you always have X and Y as different indices coupling to phi. And you need this structure to get. If I had both x here, it doesn't work. It has to work with x and y. It has to be off diagonal in the orbital space with the sigma 2, if you wish, in the orbital space. That's where it comes from. Okay? All right, so that's the basic idea. So now let me just show you some results. We're not experts at quantum Monte Carlo. I'm hoping experts will now use this method to solve this field theory. Okay, I won't claim you're going to solve the Hubbard model, but I claim this is the important part of the Hubbard model. all right, so but just to show the results, now I'm going to move things around a little bit because I got two bands and things get a bit messy once you're in the antiferromagnetic phase. So first of all, I'm going to move the center of the Brillouin zone to there. Okay, so I'm going to put this in the center. So this is the same picture, okay, no change. Then I'm going to take this band, the red band, and move it by k. So I'm going to move that red band down here and this red band up there. So when you do that, you get this. And now you can see everything very clearly. Now these are actually the hot spots. And here you have one copy of this theory, and here you have another copy of that theory. You have four copies of the hotspots, and they're right sitting exactly where they should. It's all very local in this formulation. And so when you go into the antiferromagnetic phase, this is what the Fermi surfaces will look like in this way of writing it. If you write it in the original way, it's a huge mess, so let's just do it this way. Okay, and you haven't, symmetry, square lattice symmetries, rotation, translations, they're not really crucial for any of this. This works as long as you have two separate flavors of fermions. Okay, so here's the actual result of the Fermi surface, or the electron occupation number. As you change this coupling R, R is this thing here. And so you go from R negative being the Higgs phase, where you have the pocket-like Fermi surfaces, to R positive, which is the symmetric phase with a large Fermi surface. So this is, is a Monte Carlo simulation showing Fermi surface reconstruction. I'm not aware of any other Monte Carlo simulation that has even seen even this much at some generic density. So that's very nice. So now we can also look for the nature of the transition. So we haven't studied it very carefully to give you any exponents yet. But we looked at something called the Binder equivalent, and that scales very well for a second order transition at around 0.25, roughly. This is relatively small systems, 14 by 14 on our little computers. We think this can be scaled up, no problem. And then we looked at the pairing instability, looked at pairing in all channels, spin singlet, spin triplet, S wave, D wave, whatever. Only one is strong, and that's D-wave spin singlet. And it's maximum fairly close to the critical point. So now, of course, this is at zero temperature. Now we have to scale this. We can try to even get TC. In principle, there's a lot of things can be done. But this is pretty good evidence already. This is just the first pass of D-wave pairing and superconductivity, along with Fermi surface reconstruction. So now I just want to draw attention to another curious feature that I worried a lot about. You notice RC, the critical point, is here. And if you look at the maximum in the superconductivity, it's a little bit to the right. okay. So this, that's another whole other talk that I've given on other equation. This, we think, is related to competing order effects, that once you're in the superconducting phase, you suppress the antiferromagnetism. And of course, the sign of it is right. And I also want to notice there's a similar effect here in the experimental data, although the authors don't mention it. If you look at the quantum critical point for where the spin density wave order disappears in the superconducting phase, that's somewhere here. But if you look at these effective mass values that were measured at high fields in the normal state, they seem to diverge. Well, it depends on how you continue this, of course. But at a point that's, noticeably to the right of that point. Okay. I know this is not a big deal, but anyway, I think it's a good, so there are many other measurements which I won't show, especially on the electron dope cube rates, where that same shift is consistently seen in many, many compounds. Okay. All right, so how am I doing on time? That's the end of the main part of my talk. 15 minutes, okay, great. Good. Questions so far before I start saying, well, I have just a few more things to say, but yeah.
So when you change the doping, you also change the size of the Fermi surface.
So in our simulation, we're not changing the doping. We are at some fixed chemical potential. But there's no problem with changing the doping. We can also change the doping.
But presumably, you need a large Fermi surface in the sense that when it gets reconstructed, you get the overlapping happening.
Well, this is a large Fermi surface here, this thing here.
But if you dope it, you might move into a small Fermi surface region just by having a small dope.
I'm not sure I understand. So we started at this high doping regime where you have just one big Fermi surface. In this new coordinate system, that's what this is.
As you come towards the antiferromagnetism, you shrink the size of your Fermi surface.
Okay, so in this model, even in half filling, there's no mod insulator. It's a metal all the way down to half filling. Well, sorry. No. Okay, I think, no, that's not right. So as you decrease the doping, you're going to reconstruct the Fermi surface into electron and hole pockets. And if you keep increasing the decreasing the doping, first of all, these will become of equal size, and they'll both vanish. So you will become an insulator at some point. You're basically one of them will vanish, and then So if you decrease the doping, first one of them will vanish, and then this will shrink to zero, and then you get an insulated half filling. So you have an insulator with antiferromagnetic order. So you have antiferromagnetic half filling. When you dope it, you form small hole or electron pockets. And eventually, so let's say I'm hole doping, so you'll first form hole drop pockets. Then before the transition to the large Fermi surface, you also have to form electron pockets. So that, that's controversial what that's seen in the hole dope cuprates. But conversely, in the electron dope cuprates, hole pockets have been seen. So that was the original data I showed you. I didn't spend time on it, which is really quite a noticeable, significant feature of this data. You're doping with electrons, but you see hole pockets. There you go. Yeah, here. So this is at very high, this is electron doping. You've got a large Fermi surface. Then as you decrease the doping, these are the electron pockets, but there's a hole pocket right there and there. So on the electron dope side, you do see exactly that. You first see electron, you see the large Fermi surface, then you see electron and hole pockets, then you see the hole pockets disappear, and then you see the electron's pocket disappear. And that sequence hasn't been seen on the hole dope side, but on the electron dope side, it's definitely been seen. So which is exactly what the simple theory would predict. Or not so simple. I mean, it's still quite complicated. Yeah.
Like you show this supercontinuity, but in which sense you show? Is you check this, are you calculating this fluctuation or correlation function?
Two-point correlation function of delta.
Yeah. And then the, so they really became a constant or just an enhancement,
Well, okay, so it's a 14 by 14 system. Well, okay, there's certainly caveats, but it looks fairly convincing to us. So you're taking L by L system, and you're looking at the correlation function from along the diagonal or along from delta of 0 to delta of L over 2, so as far as you can get. And then you increase the system size. Okay, and you can see that that's 10, 12, 14. I mean, it seems to saturate quite nicely. That's the largest we can do, and it's also at some finite temperature. We are scaling temperature with system size, but you should really send temperature to infinity first and then system size to get long range order. Otherwise, you get power law decay consistent with costless Thouless. These are all things that are doable now because the whole thing is under control. Yeah. That's on the list of things to do. Yeah, no, you're right. We should do that exactly. See how much this is sensitive to the angle. Yes, that's something the theory predicts, and it's incentive to do almost anything else except that angle. Let's see if that comes out. No, we haven't done it. When Ares wrote the code, I mean, this is a new thing for all of us to write this Fermion determinant Monte Carlo, and there's a lot of things to do, and part of the reason for me giving the talk is hopefully people will do some of these things. but this is the simplest model. In fact, the only model for which I think you can do controlled quantum Monte, you can actually solve in 2D and see Fermi surface reconstruction and superconductivity. I don't think any other model has all of those features.
Quantum.
QMC.
Is it quantum in the same sense as lattice gauge theory is quantum, or is
yes.
it something
more? No. Well, okay. In this matter, I mean, people do Monte Carlo of the Ising model for thermal, and they don't call it quantum Monte Carlo, just Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
I guess it also has fermions. It has fermions. So there's a fermion determinant, so very quantum in that sense. It's just that the fermions don't come in a way that you can control their sign, at least as far as that field theory is concerned. All right, well, I guess I would say that this is, there are all these examples of...
Is the Monte Carlo three-dimensional?
It's in space and time.
It's in space and time.
Correct.
It has a big rotation or not?
Yes, it's done in imaginary time.
So it's very much similar to...
Yes. I mean, lattice gauge theory, in particle physics, you don't have the sign problem because you work at zero density, and particles and holes, all their determinants come with a square. In everything in lattice gauge theory, except when you start doing quark-gluon plasma, then you'll run into these same issues. But if you're talking about zero-density lattice gauge theory, there's no sign problem there. It's just a matter of evaluating the determinant, the quark of the quark determinant, and doing it rapidly, which is still a huge problem, but it's not as bad as the sign problem. So this also has a corresponding determinant that has to be evaluated. So, it's not as simple as the Ising model. You can't do Wurm algorithms or anything. It still work, but it's not exponentially hard work. Okay, so in 5 minutes, let me just say something about the hold of cuprates. What's happening in there where antiferromagnetism and superconductivity is not present? So one scenario that we've been playing with, and also Xiaogang and some of his group members have been studying, is, although in a somewhat different language, so in our approach, we would say that, okay, let's start with this critical point. And this way of thinking, there are two things that happen at this red line. One is that you break the global symmetry in the spin rotation symmetry. So you have the Higgs transition. And the other is you reconstruct the Fermi surface, which is saying the fermions get a mass in the particle theory language. So now the question we want to ask is, can you separate those two things? Can you get something in between where you don't break the symmetry, but the fermions still have a mass? Or in this language, you completely preserve local global spin rotation symmetry, but you still have the pockets. And so this is something we call the FL star phase, with no symmetry breaking, but Fermi surfaces that look somewhat like this. Okay, I won't go into the details of how such things can happen. We can, at least for some models, we can prove that such a thing is possible. And one of those models is this Z2 FL star phase in this recent work with Matthias Punk. We start from a TJ model, and using the spin-on, dope-on approach of Xiaogang and others, we get these hole-like pockets with an area which is X in a phase that doesn't break spin rotation symmetry. And this may or may not have something to do with various observations in photoemission in the cuprates. But let me just say a few things, and I'll stop here. So if you have this new exotic phase where, if you wish, we have reconstructed the Fermi surfaces. In other words, this term here is operational. So as far as this term is concerned, I can replace phi by a constant. So the fermions reconstruct. But nevertheless, phi is actually not a constant. It's still fluctuating. So it's kind of an intermediate mysterious phase that sounds very mysterious when you say it that way, but there are other ways of thinking about it that make it very natural. And one of the characteristics of this new phase is that it has topological order in the sense that that there must be additional excitations in addition to the electrons. In addition to this Fermi surface of ordinary electrons, there have to be other excitations which carry half-integer spin, but don't carry any charge or spin-ons. And then also there are gapless or gapped spinless gauge excitations. And there's a topological proof by Oshikawa of the Luttinger theorem, the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface equal to total density. And what we argued was that once you have these other excitations, there's a loophole in Oshikawa's proof, which shows you that actually you can violate the Luttinger theorem and get much smaller pockets. Anyway, so this is possibly, it would be very exciting if this is what's happening in the whole of cuprates, but that's not at all clear. I mean, that would be, from some perspective, the most exciting thing. But You know, we're a long way from that. But anyway, the one message here is that we've understood so much about now fractionalized phases and topologically ordered phases of insulators at fixed density. It would be wonderful if now people started thinking about even richer possibilities, I think, that are present in systems that are metals, that are compressible and have variable density and also have fractionalization. Okay, so let me just end by answering a few questions. So question posed by Scalapino's paper would be, you know, can you get high temperature superconductivity near onset of antiferromagnetism? And I think you have pretty good evidence that indeed that can happen, certainly high enough to, you know, I think very promisingly apply to the electron dope cuprates and the nictides. How should we extend this to the whole dope cuprates? Well, most probably something else going on in between, either fractionalization or something not as exciting, depending on your perspective. Okay, that's my proposal for what Fermi strange metal is ultimately due to. It's a very general term that almost nobody will disagree with that, I suspect. Okay, thank you. Okay, so if you remember Oshikawa's proof, so he takes your Fermi liquid and on a torus. So you take a torus, and then you insert flux phi in the center of the torus. And as you insert the flux phi, you then figure out the momentum that the system gains. And then by equating the flux change to the momentum, you get Leptinger's theorem. So that's his proof. So now there's one assumption in his proof. His assumption in his proof is that as you slowly insert flux phi, the only low energy excitations are the quasi particles near the Fermi surface. That's the assumption. If you assume that's the only low energy excitation, then you have a proof. Okay, so this is completely different from Luttinger's or Landau's proof. Okay, however, there's some other low energy excitations. In particular, in this case, if you have a Z2 FL star, then give you a Vison. You can introduce a Vison, which has zero energy, because you have a topological degeneracy of the ground state. And that can eat up exactly enough of the momentum to give you the modified Luttinger theorem with area delta, not 1 plus delta. Okay, so it's this. So if you have these spinless gauge excitations for a Z2 case, that would just be a Vison. So just the presence of the Vison is enough to show you that you can violate the Luttinger theorem. So I think that's quite interesting because, you know, it's bringing together this intrinsic property of metals, of Fermi surface volume, something that you can measure in a photoemission experiment to topological gauge excitation. So when people ask me, how can you measure topological order, my response is measure the volume of the Fermi surface. That has information on this. Yeah, it will still work. I mean, you just need one excitation. For the Z2 case, you know, you would get, I'm pretty sure you go from volume 1 to 1 plus delta to 1 plus delta. But for U1, well, the U1, well, first of all, U1 FL star is not stable because you need gap because of the instanton effects. You need some fermionic excitation that carry gate charges to stabilize it. But U1 FL star, well, okay, then maybe if you have enough Dirac fermions, spinons, if the spinons are gapless, you could stabilize it, but generally it won't be stable. But the Z2 is stable. But there you have a whole continuum, and there's certainly enough, you know, I don't know how to apply Yoshikawa's argument, but it's clear that it doesn't apply. I don't know how to extend it under good control. But there's many other low energy excitation in addition to the quasi particles, so we can't even use the argument. Yeah.
It's a follow-up question. I think I'm not sure if the other additional, like bisons, the spinons, they are all electromagnetic neutral, right?
So yes. Yes.
They don't carry the gate charge inserted flux here. So how does the insertion of the gate normal electromagnetic
case. Oh gosh, I have to remember. Well, okay, so this is for the U1 case, you can transfer one from the other. That's
okay.
Yes.
Why not? How do you do that?
No, okay. No, I meant for the, you start with the U1 theory and you break U1 down to Z2. Okay, it's the details and it's been a few years ago, but you have, you can always transfer pi flux from the electromagnetic gate charge to the Z2. And once you use that freedom, you can show that this works.
I think one of them will carry both electromagnetic charge and the Z2 gate charge.
Which one?
One of the particle must carry this.
It depends how you say it, I guess. I mean,
it could be spin and could be hold on, but it's one, I think one of them carry both charge.
I mean, spin on, there's no hold on here. There's only spin on and vice on, and electron or dopant.
okay.
So,
yeah.
Well, you know, there is this. Okay, there may be a nicer way of saying it, but if you, at least the way I think of it, there's this Higgs condensate of charge two, and that kind of links the electromagnetic gauge flux with the Poisson flux to maintain the Higgs condensate. It is at the same value, and then it works out. It would be, I agree, this argument should be cleaned up, but there's nothing wrong with it. I'm sure it can be stated in a better way. Yeah, let me think about it. Good question.
More questions?
Okay.